Hello and welcome to IRI Growth Insights, featuring IRI thought leaders, industry partners, and guests. For more than 40 years, IRI has been known for its invaluable data, but these podcasts delve into the insights the data reveal to fuel disruption and market growth for CPG, retail, healthcare, and media industries. I'm your host, Tanya Shuckart, coming to you from IRI's corporate headquarters in Chicago. All right, so I'd like to welcome a brilliant guest to the show today, someone I've had the pleasure of introducing hundreds of times, it feels like, over the last few years as a contributor to Forrester and Gartner Research. I know his bio well. He's the president of IRI's Media Center of Excellence, Nishat Mehta. Welcome, Nishat.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So many of our audience members know you as a regular speaker at industry conferences and events. Like Advertising Week and the ARF, which I think you are a board member of. Your work's been published in Forbes, the American Marketing Association. So I want to tap a little bit into that advertising knowledge and expertise and talk about consumer audiences and something we talked about in an earlier podcast with our colleague, Vijoy, in-flight optimization. So just to roll it back a little bit for our CPG and retail marketers, let's do a quick advertising lesson from like the 30s. Let's talk about midday dramas. Or what are they called now?
Yeah, no, you're right. I hope you're not implying that I was alive in the 1930s.
No. But,
yeah, I mean, I think one of the things for me that's interesting to note is to connect the way in which consumers consume content and advertising. I mean, that goes back really since the beginning of time. And I think that what you're referring to very specifically is the notion of the soap opera. And, you know, not everyone knows that the reason why it was called a soap opera is because certain soap brands would actually sponsor the entire hour. I think Ivory Soap might have been the first one. P&G basically decided that that was one way to advertise, was to allow an hour of drama to be played and periodically remind you that the entire hour of content was brought to you by Ivory Soap, and hence the name soap opera. Obviously now that can be converted to the, you know, a number of other advertisers that obviously advertise during those daytime TV shows.
Right. Yeah, I don't think a lot of people knew that. I mean, I didn't really know that either. So that was an interesting bit of insight. And then so fast forward to the 50s where, you know, winning for brands was determined by really understanding your audience more than your competitors. And that hasn't really changed, right? But the marketing world has changed dramatically. And especially when we talk about direct-to-consumer or D2C, sometimes that leaves CPGs, we've talked about this, on the bottom shelf, if you will. But what are the challenges? Let's get through what the challenges are for CPGs.
Yeah, no, I think it's fair. I mean, I think, you know, just briefly on your point around sort of the 50s, I think the timing on that is pretty clear. I think it's common for people to think that data science is somehow this relatively new 21st century idea. But I think it is important to go back in time and realize, and, you know, Mad Men certainly made it clear
right. That
the IBM computer that was helping them with television advertising existed in the late 50s and early 60s. And then I think you go even further back and you could argue that the average mind of the shop owner going back, you know, 150 years was effectively performing some form of data science in that he or she knew all of the customers that came in and was mapping the products that he or she had available to him to the customers that came into the store and basically doing the kinds of things in small scale that we now ask machines to do at much larger scale.
Yeah,
but I think
right.
Coming back to your question, CPG is the true definition of large scale. And so I think when we talk about the importance of you know, leveraging data, it's because, you know, CPG is one of the best places to do that because of the fact that people make purchases over and over again for the same products. The challenges, however, have always sort of prevented us from truly achieving what I think is sort of where we should be seeing advertising going across all industries. And I think those challenges largely fall into a handful of buckets. So first and foremost, CPG is the industry that probably is going to be the last one to move fully online, just mm-hmm. by virtue of the fact that consumers need CPG products within an hour or two of actually deciding that they needed them. And so
right. The
last mile delivery is challenging in the world that we live in today. And then I think, too, there is a sort of a the relative expense factor that when you're buying a 99-cent bag of chips, the cost associated with home delivery just doesn't make economic sense. And so that is a challenge in terms of CPG purchases today and in the very, you know, sort of distant future are likely to still be made in physical stores for quite some time. I think second,
you know, just on that point, as an example, this is going to seem crazy, but so there's this lipstick, and I did not plan on bringing this up today. There's this lipstick that I just looked it up on Amazon because I didn't want to have to go out and buy this very specific one for our daughter's dance competition. I wanted to just have Amazon deliver it. $30, but in the store it's $12. So I text messaged my daughter and said, no, see, now I got to go to Sephora and I got to make that purchase. But I didn't plan on bringing that up at all, but that just speaks to your point, right?
Exactly. No, that's exactly right. I think the related to that then is the idea that online behavior is oftentimes not a pretty good indicator of any sort of purchase intent or signal. To the example you just raised, my sense is there were a series of offline actions that needed to take place to cause you to realize you needed the piece of lipstick,
right,
and that it wasn't until you actually went onto the retail site to actually purchase something that it became clear from your online behavior that you were in the market to purchase the product.
Exactly.
And again, some of that is due to the short purchase cycle associated with CPG products. Some of it is associated with just the habitual people that we are, in that 95% of the CPG products in my home are likely to be replaced by the exact same product when I need to replenish them. And so the second sort of challenge that I think CPG marketers have is that there isn't a lot of great intent signal that you can gather from a consumer's behavior. And therefore, some argument has been made that online behavior isn't really, you know, the data that you can collect about consumers, which, you know, previously has been very much focused on online behavior, isn't really a good indicator and therefore not all that valuable as it relates to CPG marketing.
Yep.
I think the last area that's probably of interest to me is that because of the challenges that, you know, the first two challenges, I think many CPG marketers have effectively grown up sort of being comfortable with proxies for measurement of their media campaigns, proxies like brand equity metrics, purchase intent signals, recall, things along those lines, and then those have translated into things like click-through rates and other metrics like that. And I think what we find more often than not is really what CPG brands should care about are some combination of two things. Did you drive case volume in the short term, and did you increase loyalty with your consumers in the long term? And I think that we're beginning to realize that it's not just the latter category of loyalty, brand equity metrics, but rather the former combines with the latter to truly measure whether or not media is a good investment.
Right. So maybe we should frame this up for, frame it up in terms of what it means for targeting audiences and some trends that are emerging. Is that a good segue into that?
No, I think that's a good point, because you're right. My hope in this discussion is not to disappoint people with all the challenges, but rather to identify the opportunities that we've now begun to see, really probably in the last, call it decade or so, I think. And there are also, I think, a handful that are important. So first and foremost, offline data is becoming more useful in targeting exercises. Sort of an influx of identity resolution partners in the space that now make it possible for things like loyalty card data to actually be tied to online personas. Mm-hmm. And that obviously feeds digital marketing, where now CPG marketers, instead of focusing on, again, online behavior, which we've sort of established doesn't necessarily have much correlation to offline purchase, they can actually use offline purchase. So if a beverage manufacturer wants to reach individuals that actually have bought their product previously or have bought in the category but don't buy their brand, or buy less of their product in the, you know, 2 quarters ago than they did 4 quarters ago. These are all things now that can be derived based on actual purchase behavior rather than, again, other sort of non-indicative or non-predictive signals. So just the sheer ability to get access to offline purchase behavior and bring it online is a huge trend that I think CPG companies need to start paying more attention to. I think second is, again, an expectation previously that CPG advertising really wasn't measurable until weeks after a campaign ended. And so your sort of test and learn process, which again, you know, the world of data science is all about, the cycle time for a test and learn was 12, 16, you know, sometimes 20 weeks. And if the idea is that in any given year, you can only really run three tests, you're not really learning at the same speed as the other industries that you might otherwise be sort of competing for consumer attention. Mm-hmm. And the good news now, again, is that this data that I alluded to is oftentimes available next day. And right. as a result, if I know that a consumer actually saw an ad on Tuesday, went into the store on Thursday and made a purchase, and today is Friday, I actually can modify the way in which I communicate with that consumer over the weekend, at least online. And that turnaround time is allowing for much more significant optimization and just greater learnings that can be applied over and over again.
Right.
And then I think the last area is just sheer volume. As I alluded to earlier, the CPG category is an interesting one because of the hundreds of billions of transactions that take place every year across the country.
Yep.
That volume is sometimes quite difficult for the average brand to, you know, process and understand. And as we're beginning to see improvements in machine learning, artificial intelligence, augmented decision making, a host of these things where the machine can actually help the human brain process what would otherwise have been just an impossible amount of data. That combination, I think, is allowing us to do things that we previously have never been able to do and therefore just kind of gave up or found alternative, less accurate proxies for.
Yeah. You mentioned something earlier when we were talking about online behavior and how online behavior is not necessarily a predictor for future purchases, but that's not necessarily true for CPGs from a, you know, you can actually predict, right? With you're the king of anecdotes, Nishat. So I already know what you're going to say here because I've heard you say it before, but you can predict with some pretty good certainty, right? I'm just going to be quiet and let you see. You have a Tide detergent analogy that I think is perfect. So,
it's a fair point. I mean, I think, If we look at, you know, if anyone who's listening to this podcast just thinks about their own consumption behavior, oftentimes the best indicator that you're about to be in market to buy a consumer good is that you have run out of the prior purchase that you made of that consumer good. And especially in categories you mentioned, Tide, for instance, or so in sort of the laundry detergent category, depending on the size of a household and maybe the age of the kids or pets in the household, you can pretty much determine based on a purchase of a 44-ounce bottle of liquid detergent when that household is going to be back in market.
Right.
And the same holds true really for any category. Again, there are going to be certain categories for which purchases are made every week. You know, things like salty snacks, things like candy and chocolate and you know, confections, things like that, that maybe there are frequent purchases, but toilet paper and paper products and laundry detergent and, you know, condiments and, you know, a host of things along those lines do have purchase cycles associated with them.
Yep.
And so to your point, signal or intent is now less about me discovering or beginning the process of learning about a brand or a category, defining a need. And it's more about replenishment. And in fact, you're right. We have quite a bit of information associated with that. It just happens to be the offline purchase behavior, again, that is driving the ability for me to know when you will next be in market for a particular product.
Right.
And so that is a huge benefit, again, in our space, more so than it would be in, say, the auto space or the, you know, travel space, where things tend to be far less predictable.
Right, right. So, so tying it back to, consumer purchasing data, strong targeting mechanism. This is sort of how, and I know that we don't want to make this a commercial for IRI, but there is some learnings here to build on what you're talking about, which is custom audiences, right? And how those are, leveraged, and then how you can, refine the campaign over time based on the purchases that you're seeing happening, right?
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. So, we've been on a journey, I think, of of trying to understand that while we think, you know, the advent of consumer purchase data and the ability to introduce it into the ecosystem is so incredibly valuable, it's not the only thing that marketers care about. At the end of the day, there are two, oftentimes at least two goals for your average marketer. One is to bring new consumers into the family. Mm-hmm. And then two is to capture as much headroom within the household that you can in your, in the category that, in which they purchase. And if you solely focus on historical purchase behavior, you'd really be over-rotating to the second of those two objectives. So right. The acquisition aspect of a marketing budget is still a fairly involved process and oftentimes does require you to reach out to individuals that haven't actually previously purchased your brand or, for that matter, may never have purchased in the category. And so I think there is a very good balancing act between amongst a couple of things here, really three things, right? One is use the data you know. So there is accurate data about what people have previously purchased. And, and that data could be people that have previously purchased your brand. It could be people that have purchased the category but not purchased your brand, for which that is a potential good way to acquire new households. Two, there is some notion of modeling that has to occur in the sense that not everybody has a loyalty program. And so if somebody goes to a Walmart and pays cash to buy a particular product, that purchase is effectively blind to any marketer. A marketer would not know that that purchase had taken place tied to that particular household.
Right.
And so at some point, there does need to be some modeling that takes place to reach out to that set of consumers. And that set of consumers is quite large. So that's sort of the second thing, is the blending, if you will, of very highly accurate deterministic audiences alongside the modeled audiences to pick up the rest of the market. And then I think for me, what's really become valuable here is to, again, focus on what a number of other industries have really popularized, which is the idea that don't let perfect be the enemy of the good. Get something good enough out in market with the knowledge that you can then optimize based on immediate results as quickly as possible. I think all too often we find ourselves in a variety of decisions that we make trying to get to the level where we have 100% certainty. And to be honest, with the ways in which consumers are changing their behavior so quickly, the time it takes for you to quote unquote reach 100% certainty almost by definition means you are no longer at 100% certainty because the consumer has changed since you collected the behavior that informed your decision. And so we've been really trying to move our clients to a market or to a mindset that focuses more on getting something that might be 70% good enough into the market, but then quickly, within the first week, the second week, they're optimizing. And getting closer and closer to that sort of 100% level.
Right. So that's a great dovetail into speed, right? When we talk about speed. So let's talk about some delays, for CPGs and what's become acceptable for advertisers and not.
Yeah. So you have two ends of the spectrum here, right? You have what I alluded to at the sort of top of this discussion around CPGs have typically, in the past, maybe a decade ago, they were comfortable waiting, 20 weeks before they knew whether or not a campaign was actually useful or not. The opposite end of the spectrum is a remarketer, somebody who's literally, identified an individual on their website who put something in a shopping cart, abandoned it, and then is reaching back out to them 5 minutes later on a third-party website.
Right.
Those are the two ends of the spectrum. And I think, to be fair, CPG, it's going to be a while, quite a while before CPGs are at the speed of, you walked into a grocery store, you walked out without buying something, and 5 minutes later, your mobile device is actually advertising to you.
Right.
Nor do I think the average consumer wants that, because the consumer has actually physically left the grocery store. And again, until we get to a home delivery world that is commercially viable, they're going to be potentially upset that the ad didn't arrive to them before they got to the grocery store versus arriving it to them after. But I think all of that basically says is that there is a middle ground. And I think that middle ground is, needs to account for the fact that in the CPG world, knowing whether or not you acted on an advertisement requires me to give you the time that your family would normally take to visit the actual store that you would normally buy the product at. So if, again, you make your typical shopping experience is a Saturday morning stock up trip, I advertise to you on Tuesday, knowing how you did on Wednesday isn't going to be valuable to me. I really do need to wait until the following Saturday before I know if my ad had some action on you. And so again, that middle ground to us typically does, you know, take into account the notion of a weekly sort of shopping experience. It may move faster again as consumers, the trend of consumers is to do more top-up trips rather than kind of the stock-up trip. And again, we're prepared for that. At the end of the day, the data is coming in daily, and then we sort of slow it down before we relay it to marketers, yeah, just to make sure that they're not making optimization decisions based on sort of incorrect assumptions.
Yeah, right. I know, I remember maybe a decade ago when this concept of the mobile mind shift came out, and, you know, marketers were being told, you know, with mobile advertising, you want to reach consumers in context in their time of need. That hasn't changed, right? That's essentially what you're saying right now. It's contextual, and then when they need it. And if you're marketing to them too early, you've missed your opportunity. Too late, same thing.
Correct. And then if you're, but to your point, even if you're reaching me with the ad at my time of need or my time of discovery, you can't know whether I acted on the ad until I have the next opportunity to purchase.
Right.
And in a world where that's still mostly done at Sephora or, right, you know, at a Walmart or a Kroger, you need to wait until I physically visit the store before you measure the results of the ad.
Right. Yeah. And speaking of that Sephora, that lipstick, it's an annual purchase too. So if there's listening devices right now, I don't need that lipstick every 6 weeks. It's a 1 year purchase. But anyway, I digress. I want to talk a little bit about all the acronyms. Right, to start? The AI, the ML, the ADM. So let's talk a little bit about these techniques, right, and how important they are.
Sure. Yeah. So I think there's a number of ways to think about it. I oftentimes use the sort of, in my opinion, umbrella acronym of augmented decision making. Mm-hmm. I think the notion of the word augmented is starting to become much more of an understandable concept for the vast majority of consumers as we start to look at augmented reality, right? And we start to look at, you know, capabilities for our phone to be able to overlay the real world with things that a machine or a computer actually develops. The notion of a, you know, walking on Google Maps and it actually tells me where I'm walking to, or a Yelp app that actually puts ratings on top of the physical image when I hold my camera up to the street that I happen to be on. Right. Those are all things that I think we're beginning to understand, that going back, you know, maybe dating myself, but going back to the release of Terminator 2, I believe in 1989, you know, the notion of just having some machine that overlays reality.
Yeah.
That to me is the umbrella term. That is what we are all asking for. It is the idea that I, as the human, still want to be the one to make the decision on how my dollars are invested. I just want to make that decision based on all of the relevant data given to me when it is most relevant.
Right.
And so if you can picture that as a set of glasses that I'm wearing on my head, more likely it's a set of screens that I'm looking at on a computer. That is really, to me, the term that we should all be using going forward. It's what people want. Now, of course, what generates the actual content that I see on the screen that is helping me make the decisions that I make can be a set of deterministic if A, then B type rules,
right,
or more likely, because let's face it, with 330 million people in this country and, you know, 126 million households, and frankly, each one of them making decisions in ways, mm-hmm, that can't really be predicted by a centered you know, marketer, you kind of need a computer to be sifting through all of that and making up the rules, looking, right, at the data and determining what rules come out of that. I'll give you one example. An interesting example is something that oftentimes refers to market structure and truly what products actually compete with other products. So if I'm a Campbell's soup, am I competing against other soups, or am I competing against other ready-to-eat meals, or am I competing against a decision to actually order in takeout or order in delivery? Two, 3 decades ago, it would have been very clear to say that my category is soup. Maybe it's ready to eat soups or condensed soups. Clearly, the world we live in now, with the ability to identify with individual consumers, for instance, a scenario where a store is out of stock for a particular brand or flavor that a consumer typically buys, what decision do they make as an alternative? Do they buy the Progresso soup next door, or do they actually go to a completely different aisle and buy some completely different meal choice, a meal kit, for instance? Those are the kinds of things that a machine helps us process across the hundreds of millions of changes in decision-making that people actually make to help define a broader definition of category, which starts to have some real play into media, because now I'm not just targeting individuals that buy soup. I'm targeting individuals that make decisions in place of buying soup that might be completely outside of my category. And so there's, again, an example where the machine learning algorithm is able to take in what that store owner 150 years ago might have been able to take in for his one store serving, you know, 4,000 townspeople. A machine is now actually able to take all of that in and ultimately provide the recommendations that get displayed to me in some sort of an augmented decision-making interface.
Right, right. So just so, I mean, maybe there's, you know, podcasts out there on augmented decision-making, but just, you know, at a, you know, real basic level, is it that you have a computer that's basically, you mentioned this, if this, then that, this sort of decision tree sort of thought process, but the computer's handling that for you. And what makes it an augmented decision is that you, the human, get the opportunity to actually make the decision, right? So they're is that exactly it?
Right. Yeah. That's exactly right. Because I think the challenge with machine learning is it automates the history, right? It automates what happened in the past. And as a result, if the assumption here is that no one ever changes their behavior ever, and we just always just buy the same things that we always bought before, then the machine will do a great job of that. But ultimately, it is up to the human to realize that the consumer is fundamentally different than it was a week ago, a month ago, a year ago. And that comes from knowing, you know, the current events, the sort of the current zeitgeist in the in the country, in particular regions, a specific weather condition that took place in a particular part of the country. Again, these are all things that, when factored into a whole host of historical decisions, oftentimes require a human to take a chance on what might be different in the future. And ultimately, it's those chances that lead us to a future state. In a lot of ways, I use an analogy here around sort of just straight up evolution, right? Human evolution. If the idea is that evolution was always perfect replication of our parents in ourselves, then humans would never evolve. We would just simply be sort of mixes of the current, humans that live in the prior generation.
Yep.
It's the introduction of a mutation that is ultimately what allows natural selection and evolution to take place. That notion of the introduction of a mutation is something that machines are probably not going to be as good at as a human brain will.
Right. You just took me back to eighth grade biology, I think. So let's talk a little bit about, because this is all super exciting, you know, this is super exciting for marketers, you know, the artificial intelligence pieces, the ML pieces, mixed with just data. What excites you about digital media and CPG? What a big, broad question.
Yeah, it's a very broad question. We could do an entire podcast on this.
Yeah.
I think there is a tendency, I think, for a lot of trend spotters to call on the sort of death of advertising.
That
50% of consumers have now downloaded an ad blocker. Mobile's a completely different world because in-app advertising isn't really taking off.
Yeah.
Subscription video on demand is a big deal. And, you know, Netflix is never going to advertise and people will just pay their $12.99 or $8.99 or whatever it is to buy ad-free content. I take a very different approach to this, which is that in my opinion, I don't think we as the average consumer understand how many industries are propped up by advertising. At the end of the day, all of content, all of media consumption, in some form or another has some ad supported version of it. I think you could look at a company like Amazon, and if you just looked at their sort of quarterly earnings reports, between AWS and their advertising business, that the profit from those two businesses is greater than the rest of the business, which one might argue means that Amazon's not really a retailer as much as they are below cost retailer that then uses the assets that are required to serve that market to build up a bunch of highly profitable businesses that make them the company that they are.
I would argue we could do a whole podcast on Amazon.
Correct. Exactly. Right. And so we could go on and on about the idea of industries that are supported by advertising. And to me, that doesn't go away. And so what needs to change is, one, the consumer needs to be educated that, in fact, it is the ad that you are seeing that is allowing you to receive this content or receive this service at a discount or for free, i.e. the sort of Facebook model. And then, two, I think it's important for the consumer to understand that they have some control and some choice over what ads they see. That ads, in fact, when they're done correctly, can actually be quite positive. I became a Harry's subscriber and moved away from Gillette for, you know, two decades of habit because of an ad that I saw on Facebook several years ago. Ads work when they're designed, you know, when they hit the individual at the right time. And so for me, the thing that's probably the most exciting is to begin to see the beginnings of a future of advertising that is far more consumer friendly than what we've seen in the past. And, you know, there's a couple of examples that I might, you know, bring up. One, just looking at, for instance, a platform like Pinterest, where it waits for a consumer to physically go to a specific board, a board that indicates the interest that the consumer actually has, before then presenting the individual with ads that might be relevant, right? The, you know, for the holidays this past year, we threw a party. I was, you know, in looking at my wife's Pinterest account, looking for a, you know, signature cocktail.
Yeah.
And to receive an ad for a Pernod Ricard brand or a Diageo brand makes perfect sense in that particular moment.
Right.
And in fact, that's actually quite helpful to me. I think we're beginning to see some examples where Pandora recently announced an ad unit that's voice activated. And I think it's to play up some of their own voice activated capabilities, where a question will be asked to you about whether you're hungry, for instance. And only if you respond yes, will then the actual rest of the ad for the fast food restaurant or QSR actually play for you.
Yep.
You know, we've heard Amazon and some of their thoughts around how they plan to introduce advertising into Alexa. We haven't really seen much of that.
Right.
But again, I could imagine a scenario where upon me asking a question of Alexa, a relevant ad actually gets displayed as a potential or gets read as a potential to sort of answer the question that I posed to Alexa.
Right.
And I think in that world, the consumer starts to feel a lot more like, hey, this is actually helpful to me. The marketer feels like it's quite a valuable reach out, because in some sense it's the next evolution of Google search.
It is.
You wait for a consumer to ask for intent and or to show intent, and then you deliver the response. And I think it reduces ad load. We don't get the sort of spray and pray where I'm presented with whatever the 5,000, whatever the number is, 5,000 different ad messages every single day. I get the ones that are more relevant to me, and the marketer is willing to pay more for them because I'll pay more attention to them. And that feels like it's a market that we will be headed towards, simply because advertising is not going away.
No.
It's just going to change into a form that the consumer wants it to be.
Right, right. Yeah, I love that Pandora example. You know, I don't know if a lot of folks know about it, but thanks for bringing that up, because it's interesting. You mentioned being on your wife's Pinterest and seeing ads. So then you knew what to buy her, right? Is that why? Right?
Fair. I didn't necessarily look at the boards that she follows, but you're right.
Yeah,
that would be another way to do things.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, but anyway, so this kind of brings it back to the benefit of the consumer, right? Back to those soap opera days. It's more consumer friendly, and to your point, ads aren't going anywhere. You know, and this idea of a voice activated ad unit is kind of exciting. It's like a future trend, right? For digital media, and bringing it back to in context and time of need, and even more than that, it's the consumer actually indicating, maybe even overtly, their interest and intent.
Correct.
So, just from a wrapping up perspective, this has been a great conversation, Nisha. I think we've talked about audiences. We've talked about the importance of understanding who your audience is, and then being able to on the fly optimize, in the middle of a campaign based on the insights that you're learning. I'm excited to have another conversation with you about the future of advertising and how the next generation of purchasers will consume content. So if you're interested, let's have another podcast.
I'd agree. I mean, I think, the one key area we probably could dive so much more deeply on is how consumers view using information that we know about them to better target advertising to them. And I think there's a very complex sort of interplay between obviously all of the privacy and regulatory challenges that we need to work through,
yes,
while also very clearly hearing from consumers and, you know, every survey we run that they are annoyed by brands that don't seem to understand them. There is a balance that needs to be properly associated with those two sort of extreme positions that I think really does come back to making sure the consumer understands why you know the things you know about them, and how you're making that helpful to them. I use the example all the time of, just walking into a hotel on a vacation and knowing that, for the entire 4 days that I'm there, the everybody that meets me knowing that I'm on my honeymoon, knowing me by name, knowing my preference by the pool, et cetera. Those are all things that I absolutely invite and that probably contribute to a fantastic experience at the hotel. Yet if somebody were to walk up to me randomly and mention that they knew which side of the bed I slept on that night, I would find that somewhat jarring, because I have no idea how they would have known that information. And so that's the balance we need to strike, because I think the consumer wants it. They just want to understand better the sort of chain of command on their data.
Right. They want to feel personalized without the creepy factor.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much, Nishat.
Thank you. This was fun. Look forward to doing this again.
Yeah, for sure.
Thank you for listening. Please become a subscriber and let us know what you want to learn more about. We'll serve it up in a future IRI Growth Insights episode. Look for us wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to review IRI Growth Insights. Also, visit us on the web at iriworldwide.com and connect with us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn.